From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Political polarization has many negative impacts on American society. Among them, a sharp divide over support for free speech. We'll explain. Some North Carolina lawmakers want to make it easier for victims of childhood sexual abuse to take predators to court. You'll learn how that could happen. Legislators conducted a recent debate involving advanced placement test scores at University of North Carolina system schools. You'll learn why lawmakers split over endorsing the work of the university's Board of Governors. And we'll look into the most interesting trends within the latest K-12 public school student test scores. How are students doing on reading, math, science? Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
North Carolina has elected two new members of Congress, the result of two special elections, to fill seats in the U.S. House, one in the 3rd District in eastern North Carolina, and then one in the 9th District, stretching from Mecklenburg County east all the way over to Cumberland and Bladen counties. Voters have now chosen Republicans to fill both of those seats, dashing Democratic hopes to turn them blue. So is there anything we can learn about the 2020 elections from these two races? Carolina Journal has been covering both of them quite extensively. Editor-in-Chief Rick Henderson joins us now. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
The big one, the 9th Congressional District, that's the one that the results weren't certified in 2018 due to ballot shenanigans. So we have the new race. National Democrats, National Republicans put tons of money into this thing, and yet the Republican Dan Bishop has won that race, dashing the Democrats' hopes.
That's right. He won by, we don't have all the official totals at the time we're recording this, but by about 2 percentage points, it looks like, over Democrat Dan McCready. Dan Bishop is an attorney, state senator, was a member of the state house before he became a state senator, and is someone who ran very much as a proxy for President Trump, as someone who would carry forward President Trump's agenda, someone who was a very strong cultural conservative. He had a lot to do with the House Bill 2 legislation. And so he staked out a very, very solid and pretty, impermeable, if you will, ideological position. He was a known quantity. Dan McCready was someone who was a little bit less known ideologically, but I think well known in the district because he was the person who lost in 2018 to Mark Harris in the original race that was then vacated, if you will, by the State Board of Elections. He's essentially been running for this district nonstop for 27 months. He had very, very high name recognition in the district. And he's someone who also had a very strong financial and grassroots support on his side. And so he's someone who, if any Democrat could win this district, which, by the way, has been held by Republicans consecutively since 1963, if anybody could win this one, Dan McCready probably was the guy who could do it. Marine veteran, entrepreneur, involved in the renewable energy business, touted his strong faith roots and ran very moderately. Also, did not, for instance, in the initial race against the Reverend Mark Harris, he was asked numerous times who he would vote for Speaker of the House if he had the opportunity. The Democrats won. He said, "I won't vote for Nancy Pelosi." And the question came up again and again. Well, who would you vote for? He said, "Well, it won't be Nancy Pelosi." So he was playing this role of the moderate, and it was something that that I think the Democrat would probably have to be competitive in that district. But nonetheless, second time around, he still was not able to get past the post there.
Trying to analyze this going forward, Rick. There are some folks who say this should be a big red flag for the Republicans because, as you mentioned, this is a Republican district, and Dan Bishop won it, we think, by 2 points, perhaps just a little bit more than that, when some are saying, hey, he should have really run away with that race, and he didn't, but a solid win. On the other hand, other people are saying, hey, this just shows that the Democratic Party running a more centrist, a more moderate candidate can't win because they've been taken over by much more radical leftists. Where do you land on this?
It's a great question. It's something that we may really not know until 2020, basically, because it appears that whoever wins the Democratic nomination for president is going to be somebody who is going to be from the left side of that party's perspective. And so it's not going to be someone who's going to be a moderate or centrist. I mean, it looks very likely that it's not going to be Joe Biden, who is running ahead in a lot of these polls currently, still is someone who's not a moderate by any stretch of the imagination. If you look at his voting record, if you look at his statements over the years, he's considered to be a moderate among Democrats, but he's not a moderate among, say, general political ideological maps. So the Democratic Party is going to nominate someone far to the left of President Trump, who's the almost certain Republican nominee for president. But that doesn't mean that inter and intra-district dimensions politically will make a difference in a specific race. Not all Democratic districts are governed by people who are as far left as, let's say, Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. Not all Republican districts are governed are represented by someone as much of, say, a nationalist as Donald Trump is. So, I mean, there are dynamics that are local. And the question for Democrats in places like the Ninth, where they think they have a chance, is can someone who runs independently of the party apparatus succeed, or is that message just lost because everybody's paying attention to what the cable news shows say, and they just simply have made these candidates essentially two-dimensional figures?
You mentioned Trump. What about his impact? He made the stop in Cumberland County in Fayetteville the day before the election. Mm-hmm. The vice president, Mike Pence, was also campaigning rigorously for mm-hmm. Dan Bishop. Are they the folks that are responsible for his win?
I think they certainly helped push him over the finish line. I think that that the presence there of the president and the vice president was making phone calls. He was at the phone banks. He was actually talking to voters, trying to get them out to vote. I think it did help. And also the winner of the third district, who we'll be talking about in a few minutes, Greg Murphy, appeared there as well, which was not expected. And so that was something that I think did make a difference. It did reassure voters who were inclined to vote for Senator Bishop to vote for him. Because the thing about it was, Dan Bishop only jumped into this race when it became possible in February. And he has been involved with the General Assembly throughout this year. The General Assembly is still in session right now. And so he's not been able to campaign as actively as someone who, let's say, was not currently serving in public office or somebody who was in the House.
So Dan Bishop will take that seat in the 9th Congressional District. So he will be sworn in. You mentioned the 3rd District. Greg Murphy, the Republican there, easily wins mm-hmm. that race. That was for the seat that the late Walter Jones had held for many, many years. That's why that special election was occurring. Greg Murphy goes to Congress.
Yes, but at least a 25-point win, it looks like, right now. And Greg Murphy was expected to win. He ran against Alan Thomas, the former mayor of Greenville. The situation with Murphy, as much as anything else, was that it was if the race was close, that would have been something Democrats could have gotten some cheer from. It didn't happen. Greg Murphy is a physician. He is a urologist. He's on the board of the medical school at East Carolina University. He's going to be very involved in healthcare issues. And so this is somebody else, I think, as sort of with Tom Tillis, when he came to Washington to provide some ideas about state level reforms, Greg Murphy may be able to help the Republicans in Washington with some more state level, local, federalist Medicaid policies.
And now they're both going to have to presumably run again very soon.
That's right. Don't shut down the campaign apparatus. That's volunteers right. will keep their jobs or keep their positions. So there you go.
Because 2020 is only a few months away That's on right. the calendar. But for now, that means that Greg Murphy and Dan Bishop will represent North Carolina in the U.S. House of Representatives. Of course, Carolina Journal covering all of these races. You can read it in the monthly print edition of Carolina Journal, which, by the way, is no cost to you. You can just give us a call or go online and make sure that you get your copy each month. And of course, the daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are, and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to CarolinaJournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at CarolinaJournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Political polarization impacts our society in many ways. Among them, there's a divide within the American population about protecting important classically liberal values, including free speech rights. That was the subject of a recent speech for the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society. The speaker, our next guest, Dr. Thomas Cushman, is a visiting senior research fellow at Wake Forest University, also a professor at Wellesley College. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So political polarization, we know, is causing major changes in the United States, and you say it's also affecting how people view free speech rights. How so?
Well, it's I'll talk about it today in my talk later on, but the polarization has to do with competition over competing values. So if you ask young people, for instance, in college surveys about which values they would like to see more protection of, there's a fairly strong divide that breaks down around gender, political party, race. And in a recent survey done of college students, a very good survey, a Knight Gallup poll, I believe it is, you can see the divides among the young people especially. So that, for instance, if you ask students the question, which do you prefer to have more protection, inclusion and diversity or freedom of expression? And there are very strong divides on that by significant percentage points. So, for instance, Democrats, women, African-Americans, and those three particular groups tend to favor diversity, equity, and inclusion, which are three important values in American history. But if you look at white men who are Republicans, it's completely the opposite. So you can see it on college campuses, at least which is where I work, that there's a very strong divide. It's not like they don't care about the other values. It's just they prefer protection of one value set over another. And I do believe that's also very apparent in the survey data for the general American population. As a sociologist, I pay fairly careful attention to that. That same breakdown: women who are Democrats, liberal Democrats, white women who are liberal Democrats, African American who are Americans who are Democrats, tend to favor diversity, equity, and inclusion. Whereas white male Republicans, conservatives tend to favor the defense of free speech rights. And the percentage differences are quite stark, actually.
And this, I suspect, is a change. If we looked back some years ago, you would see more general support for free speech rights.
Well, exactly. And, I'm starting to get up there in years and I see generational differences. And I never thought, for instance, as a college professor, I would have to explain why freedom of expression was important to young people. I just assume they all learn that somewhere. But evidently, they're not really learning that somewhere because they come in, many of them, come in with very little knowledge, very little understanding of the scope of the First Amendment or the jurisprudence about the First Amendment in the last several hundred years. And so you can't assume students coming into even the most elite colleges have a strong appreciation that was just assumed by people of my generation. We just didn't question it. And we were taught that. And I think now in the high schools, the students just simply they're getting more, I think, of the diversity, equity, and inclusion value system, which means you shouldn't say things that, quote-unquote, harm people or make them feel offended or uncomfortable. And that's more enforced, say, in a high school setting, which is a much more disciplinarian setting. And so when they get to college, they just keep adhering to the same value systems. And it's a hard work to convince them that freedom of expression helps everybody, especially if you want diversity, equity, and inclusion. The only way to get that is by saying why you're not included, why you're not being treated equally. And I think that's the argument I try to make.
That is the voice of Dr. Thomas Cushman, visiting senior research fellow at Wake Forest University, also professor at Wellesley College. You alluded to this, but I want to loop back to it.
Sure thing.
If a substantial portion of our young people or the American population at large values freedom of expression less than some of these other values, what sorts of problems does that create for our society?
Well, I mean, one claim that I make, the first claim that I ever make when I talk about the right of freedom of expression is that there are reasons, the reason that is in the First Amendment. Because my view is at least that the founders understood that freedom of expression, being able to make rights claims or to complain about the violation of your rights, necessitated freedom of expression. It's the right from which all other rights evolve or articulated. And you can't make any other rights claims, whether it's about equality or progressive values or any kinds of claims, without having that right of freedom of expression. But what you tend to see is people essentially not understanding the connection between the fundamental, we would say in law, non-derogable right of freedom of expression, and its connection to any kind of rights claim of injustice or violation of civil rights or anything like that. So it has to be the starting point for all other rights claims. And I think with some persuasion, you can persuade people of that. You know, how could Martin Luther King have ever fostered the civil rights movement without freedom of speech? And I had a very interesting African-American young man tell me when I said that, he said, well, he shouldn't have had to die for it. And I thought, well, that's a pretty good response, that you shouldn't have to die for expressing your right of freedom of speech. But this is what, you know, this what struck me is that it is dangerous to speak freely, and especially in a climate where there is hatred, there is violence and that kind of thing.
So we have this divide. We see this from the survey results.
Yes.
What do we do about it?
Everybody asks me that, but I think some of these things are generational. That I'm already seeing in some of the younger generations who come in, say to the college, who are 4 years younger than maybe the students who have really pushed these. These values seem to be prominent among the millennial generation, and you know we sociologists have waves of generations. I'm never going to say time will tell, but I do know that there are generational shifts in beliefs and value systems. So for instance, when anybody asks me that question, I generally tell them that if you went back in time to Berkeley in the 1960s, that that's where the site of student radicalism was, including in my own field, sociology. They took over buildings and created havoc, and they wanted to create a revolution. And I had a professor that was teaching there at the time, and he said, well, what comes after the revolution? They said, well, we don't know. We just want to have the revolution. It's never a good idea to have a revolution and not kind of know where you're going, because then you don't end very well. But the reason I bring up this story is that if you look at the data later on, in 1980, if my memory serves me right, over 50% of the students at Berkeley voted for Ronald Reagan. So I think it's – I don't think it's a one-way trajectory. I don't think freedom of speech is on the way out. If you ask the whole population, it's about 50-50. When you break down these ethnic differences and racial differences and gender differences, it becomes more pronounced. But I do think there's something like a pendulum, that there's a swing back and forth, and that we might be in a diversity, equity, and inclusion pendulum right now side. And I think that it's my hope anyway that maybe people might see that it's really not a very pleasant state to exist in a situation where you're constantly afraid to say what you think.
Dr. Thomas Cushman, yeah. Visiting Senior Research Fellow at Wake Forest University, also Professor of Sociology at Wellesley College. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers are considering new tools in the fight against child sexual abuse. Republican State Representative Dennis Rydell recently explained a bill that combines several different ideas.
It protects children from online predators. It will expand the duty to report child abuse, and it also increases prosecutorial options when there are delayed reports of juveniles who are victims of violent offenses, sexual offenses, or child abuse. And it also provides our child sexual abuse extension of the statute of limitations.
Rydell says the measure enjoys widespread support.
Senate Bill 199 enjoys the support of the North Carolina Department of Social Services, North Carolina Coalition Against Sexual Assault, Safe Child NC, Prevent Child Abuse NC, NC Alliance of YMCAs, Child Advocacy Centers of NC, North Carolina Sheriff's Association, Connect for Faith, North Carolina Conference of DAs, and the North Carolina Association of Chiefs of Police.
Not everyone is on board. Fellow Republican Representative Chuck McGrady has concerns about potential unintended negative consequences. Specifically, he worries about extending the statute of limitations for legal action tied to charges of sexual abuse.
It will revive claims that have already exceeded the statute of limitations. And more seriously, frankly, while the intent of the bill is to bring civil actions against child molesters, pedophiles, and I'm all for that, typically somebody that is accused of this is working for a school system, is working for some sort of nonprofit, and when you jump forward, you know, 20 years, go back 20 years for something that happened, the person that you want to have to pay for the civil action is not going to be the one that pays. It's going to be the school system. It's going to be the nonprofit.
Representative Dennis Rydell responded to McGrady's concerns.
The concern about who will be sued, why they'll be sued, when they can be sued, you have to understand that the average age of disclosure for child sexual abuse is 52. The age of going to 38 is nowhere near the average age. It will help us pick up a few more victims and give them their day in court, which they deserve. I encourage you to get North Carolina back on the side of being serious about preventing child sexual abuse, about helping those who have been victimized by child sexual abuse, and making sure North Carolina is not a haven, a safe harbor for predators.
You've been listening to debate about measures designed to fight child sexual abuse in North Carolina. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Advanced placement courses in North Carolina high schools generated some debate on the State House floor. The source of the debate? A bill recognizing the University of North Carolina's efforts to streamline college credit for AP courses. Republican Representative Kelly Hastings offered a simple explanation.
Simply, the bill commends the Board of Governors of the UNC system for standardizing the advanced placement credit policies.
The idea drew an objection from Democratic Representative Ray Russell.
I came to North Carolina 28 years ago as a college professor at Appalachian State, devoted most of my professional career at App State as a professor and department chair of computer science. The amendment that I've filed here deletes lines 10 through 24 of this bill, which would delete the section of commendation to the Board of Governors for basically forcing all departments to recognize a grade of 3 or greater on AP exams. The real question on these was the grade of 3. Grade of 3 on an AP exam, they go from 1 to 5, and a 3 is a marginal score, which for most cases is okay for our purposes in a STEM discipline like computer science, but particularly in our foundational courses, calculus, computer science 1, that grade of 3 is a marginal score which in reality could put students at risk of greater likelihood of not being successful. For example, in both of those courses in our department, we don't even accept our own grade of a C in those courses in order to move forward in the program. It's not because we're trying to be difficult or make life more difficult for students. It's actually just trying to ensure that they are successful when they go forward. I really do believe that this will have an adverse effect on many students in many of these courses. Again, this amendment is not to change the policy. That has already been done. It is simply to remove this commendation. In reality, folks who come from families that have a background in STEM disciplines, if my daughter or son came to me, they had a 3 on an AP exam in calculus and they were wanting to major in engineering, I would tell them, you take that course again. You don't know what you need to know in order to move forward in the discipline. So that's really what was forced on several departments. It was done hastily. It took, in 2 weeks' time, departments across the state were told that they had to make this change. The only reason that was given that they could do anything else was if they had clear, hard evidence that this shouldn't be done. The problem was that evidence didn't exist because we'd never been asked this question before.
Russell's amendment would have stopped the General Assembly from commending the UNC Board of Governors. Republican John Fraley objected.
In all due respect, I would ask you to defeat this amendment. What is in the wording of what the Board of Governors has done, and also what is in the bill that's being considered, does exactly what opposite of what Representative Russell is talking about. That you're given, each institution has the ability to go to their Board of Trustees and say if an AP grade of 3 is not adequate enough to provide the exception, and then come back to the Board of Trustees and have that approved.
Republican Kelly Hastings also responded to Russell's complaint.
I've heard a lot of misstatements today, so let me give just a little bit of history so the members understand what transpired. Many of our universities were already granting credit for a score of 3. Some of our universities were not. And so what this does is it makes it fairer for the students, so that they have an expectation as to what they can expect when they apply for AP credit, when they apply to college and it's being determined whether they have AP credit. It's retroactive and prospective in nature. It's retroactive in the fact that the students who are already in the university system can still try to get AP credit even if they started college last year. The prospective nature has to do with the year of the catalog. So, regarding their major, so if a student is a senior and they go through the audit process and it's determined that it won't benefit them because they have to accept a newer catalog of this year of course requirements, they can opt out. But if you're a younger student, a freshman or a sophomore, the catalog probably has not changed that much, so you're probably going to want to opt in. It's not mandatory. And so the Board of Governors, they were simply trying to make the process fairer. Someone shared an email from NC State that in March of this year, NC State had already implemented the process and said that, hey, students, if you want to apply for AP credit for a score of 3, call the advisor, go through the audit process, and determine if it's best for you. And so this is not mandatory. This is just simply a process of trying to make it fairer for the students.
Republican Larry Pittman of Cabarrus County explained why he supported the measure.
I feel like what we're doing by commending the board for this policy or decision is commending them for thinking outside the box. And I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. When I was in college, I took a course in psychology, and it made reference to a study that was done of some architecture students and how they did after they were through with school. And the most successful were the ones who were C students. And the way that they explained that in the study that I read said that the A and B students focused more on what somebody else had done and regurgitating what they had learned from somebody else. The C students were more interested in being creative and doing their own designs, and so they were more successful. And I think this allowing a person who scores a 3 to be able to have advanced placement is akin to that. Think outside the box a little bit and realize that people aren't always going to meet every little check mark that you think they ought to meet and still be able to succeed and able to do well as they continue to study. That's, to me, that's what this is, and I think it should be commended.
Hastings also took aim at Russell's objection to a plan to commend the Board of Governors.
If you're questioning our duty under the Constitution, our legislative process is a higher authority than an administrative rule. And so it's our duty here to state what our policy should be, especially when it's fairer for the students who have worked really hard in an AP course. And as I said, it's not mandatory. So I would encourage you to defeat the amendment.
Russell's amendment headed to a vote.
42 having voted in the affirmative, 64 in the negative, the amendment fails.
Once lawmakers rejected the amendment, the House unanimously approved the bill. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Are North Carolina kids doing better in school? Well, new state data on public school performance and student achievement finds that across all subjects and grade levels, 58.8% of North Carolina students earned what's called grade level proficiency. 44.5% met the higher standard called career and college ready. That's just part of the results that give us a window into school and student achievement right now in North Carolina. Dr. Terry Stoops has been analyzing all of this data. He, of course, is the Vice President for Research, also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
First of all, give us a sense of what is measured when it comes to student achievement. I know you've been writing about the difference between proficiency and growth.
Proficiency measures how well a student knows the subject matter in a given year on a given test, and basically will tell you how many answers they got correctly on the state test. And they set certain proficiency levels, and the students, based on how many answers they get correctly, can reach those proficiency levels. Growth is a little different because that compares an individual student performance in the current year compared to what how they performed on the tests the previous year. And basically what the state does is they have a certain projection that they use to determine what a year's worth of growth is for that child, and their performance on the state test determines if they meet that growth standard. So those are the two primary ways we measure student achievement in North Carolina. There are other measures like graduation rates and other sorts of measures that we use, but those are the two primary ones.
What was your reaction to the latest data in terms of both proficiency and growth?
Well, not much is changing, especially in reading. A lot of people were focusing in on the reading scores, the reading proficiency scores, to see if we are starting to see some benefits to North Carolina's Read to Achieve program. And this is a program that provides resources for teachers in elementary schools to improve reading instruction, specifically in grades K through 3. And so the hope of many is that we would start to see some movement in test scores because of the incredible investment we've made in Read to Achieve. And unfortunately, we're not seeing that. In math, it's a little tricky because there were some changes to the math test and the reporting standards used for math. So we really can't compare those to previous years. Math proficiency is hovering around the 59-60% range. So that certainly isn't something to write home about. We would hope that our math proficiency would be better, considering North Carolina traditionally has had very strong math instruction, has performed very well on national assessments of math. You would hope that that would be mirrored in some of the state tests that are administered every year.
We seem to be making progress in science.
Yeah, science is looking fantastic, where depending on the grade, between 7 and 8 out of 10 kids are proficient in science, and that number continues to increase. We administer two science tests in North Carolina, one in 5th grade and one in 8th grade, which is consistent with federal requirements. So those are the two tests that we really zero in on when we look at science proficiency, and students are doing very well in science. It's a real testament to the teachers that teach those subjects, that they're able to raise proficiency in 5th and 8th grade science.
I never did well in science, so I'm in awe of that data right there. So the new data that was released for the last school year also looked at school performance and gave schools a grade. What do we find there?
Well, we have a grading system in North Carolina that looks at the two factors mentioned earlier, proficiency and growth. 80% of their grade is based on proficiency and 20% is based on growth. And there's a lot of controversy about that. We're basically seeing what we would consider to be an even distribution of schools, of A and B schools compared to D and F schools. And most schools are in the middle, C's. You think of what a bell curve looks like. That's basically the distribution of school performance grades in North Carolina. And honestly, that's one of the reasons why legislators are hesitant to get rid of the system that we have right now for determining school performance grades, because it seems to distribute school performance grades in a way that makes sense along that bell curve. If you make changes, we either get a lot of A schools or a lot of F schools. And so that's one of the reasons why there's such an imbalance in the percentages used to determine school performance grades.
If I'm a parent in North Carolina and I'm trying to figure out if my child is getting a, quote, good education or not, I've got my child's personal grades. But based on all of this data, the school letter grades and the proficiency and growth levels, does that give a parent a good sense of where their child is and whether or not they should be pleased with what's happening at their school?
It's a starting point. And I think that the grading system is so much much improved compared to what we had in the past, where we would label school of progress, school of distinction, basically labels that didn't have a whole lot of meaning for parents. Parents understand a school grade, but it should be understood that that's a grade for the entire school and may not reflect how their individual student is doing, how the grade that their student is in that school is doing, or how an individual teacher is educating the children in his or her class. So it's a good starting point. Parents should look to see what the grade is for their entire for the entire school, but there are online tools that they can use to go look at the test scores for their individual children. And the state provides a tool for them to be able to do that online, or they can go into the school and look at those records for themselves. So it really is a starting point. It was always meant to just be a starting point. And many of the people that object to these school grades, believe it to be something that many parents use, but aren't using in the proper way. I think most parents understand that it may not be representative of their child.
Terry, we know that in North Carolina, we're one of the leading states in terms of providing options to parents. Parents here are demanding more options for their kids. A lot of them are choosing traditional public school classrooms because that works for them. Other families are choosing public charter schools, virtual schools, home schools, etc. In this data, did we get a sense of how public charter schools are comparing to traditional district schools?
Sure. We start to get some clues about that. And if you look at just growth rates, you see that districts are outpacing charters as far as growth, and just very slightly. But charter schools, as far as school performance grades, are outpacing districts. There are more A and B charter schools than there are A and B district schools. On the other hand, you have more D and F charter schools compared to districts. So you have some charter schools that are really outstanding and they're outpacing a lot of the district schools. Then you have some that are falling behind, quite frankly. Of course, if those schools continue to fall behind, they'll be closed. And that's the real difference here, is those D and F schools in districts will remain open and in some cases receive more money to try to repair instruction that's obviously falling short of what it should be.
There's a lot of data that has been released in this new school accountability report from the state of North Carolina. You can read all of Terry Stoop's analysis of this at johnlock.org. Terry, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the show this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlock.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlock.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.